Google could now be considered a product-driven company, but it wasn't always that way. For many years, Google's engineering-led culture cherished efficiency over user experience. Irene Au arrived at a pivotal moment in the company's history and helped shape the way that Google's products clearly value design today. Now, in her role as a design partner at Coastal Ventures, she helps startups build high-performing teams, establish design practices, mentor and grow the next generation of great designers, and design interfaces and experiences. Here is her story.
Irene Au, design partner at Coastal Ventures, thanks so much for being on Design Better.
Well, thanks for having me.
So you've got a pretty incredible, I'd say a storied career in our industry. You've been at Google and various other places and had a pretty big influence on the way design organizations are shaped. Can you just walk us through the journey you've been on the past 10, 15 years?
Sure. Actually, my career probably started earlier than that. my background's in human-computer interaction, and then before that in electrical and computer engineering. I started my career as an interaction designer at Netscape, working on the world's first commercial web browser and mail and news client and page editor and things like that. And then I joined Yahoo in 1998, where I brought user-centered design practices to Yahoo. They were kind of moving from being a web directory to a service that offered web applications and services. And they really wanted to bring in this kind of skill set to make their products easy to use. And so I ran Yahoo's design team for 8 years, built up the user experience and design practice there. And then I joined Google in 2006, where my role was essentially the same as what I had at Yahoo, but it was just working at Google, which in many ways was like the bizarro land of Yahoo, the opposite in so many ways. And in 2012, I left Google. I ended up joining Udacity and also working as an entrepreneur in residence at Trinity Ventures. And then 2 years after that, I joined Coastal Ventures. That was in 2014. Interestingly enough, I had been talking to Coastal Ventures even back in 2012 about joining as a design partner and probably would have been the first of the kind in the industry there. But at the time, I just felt like it wasn't the right opportunity for me. I still wanted to make things and be part of a company. And, 2014, I felt like, I'm ready to do this. And I really was eager to figure out how to bring better design to startups. Whereas I had spent most of my career, scaling and building up large scale consumer internet companies. Role that I have at Coastal Ventures really is an interesting way to teach CEOs how to build in design into their companies from the ground up. So that's kind of how I'm spending my time now.
So at Google, it's such an engineering-driven culture. And when you were first there, obviously, Larry had a certain perspective about the way things should work from a design perspective. Could you first talk about that a little bit and then talk about what changed over the years to the point that he seemed to really start to evangelize design?
And it's funny, like at Yahoo, when I first joined, people thought of design as being really about aesthetics and making things look good. And so I spent a lot of my time in the early days at Yahoo explaining to people that design was not just about how things look, but how they work. And at Google, it seems like Larry and Sergey really internalized this kind of understanding because they also had taken classes in human-computer interaction. But it went to an extreme where it was really all about how things worked, and not really so much about how things looked. And one analogy that Larry had used with me was like, you look at the Mac interface, for example, looks nice, easy to use, but not as efficient to use as Unix. And so that was kind of the vision that he had for Google, was that he wanted Google to be as efficient as Unix is for power users. And that's really who we were optimizing for, at least in the early stages. I think a lot of that still holds true now. But the interpretation of that has kind of evolved over time. And I think with the rise of the iPhone and the success of this paradigm shift that the iPhone introduced, which is not only beautiful and also functionally, life-changing, just as a concept, it totally changed people's understanding of what a phone was. I think this really started to shift people's notion of like how important beauty was in an experience. And so, you know, for example, like when Larry became CEO, he started to champion the importance of beauty and how that is just as important as having efficiency and functionality in an experience. He made a comment at one All Hands about white space. So, for example, whereas before we eschewed white space because we wanted to cram in as much information as possible, he pointed out that sometimes white space can be really valuable because it helps you better understand what to focus on. And you think about, like, I think it was John Coltrane, the musician, who said, like, the music is the space between the notes. I think that is often taken for granted in a lot of different ways in life. And so it was really wonderful to see Larry point that out to the rest of the company, because, that was really the beginning of a shift in the attitude and the company's understanding of what we were really going for.
Google's such an interesting example of evolution of the industry. I mean, you describe this Unix interface for the power user, which is great, you know, to be super efficient. But once you've got a much broader user base, the design philosophy or the values of a product really have to shift, because it's got to work for a lot of different people with different mental models. Can you talk a little bit about that, of like how product values and mental models can really influence your approach to design?
Yeah. It's interesting because Google has always really targeted the early adopter of technology. And the thinking was that the world is going in this direction. And so if you target the early adopter, eventually everybody else will come along. And this is very different from how most people think about design, because, you know, at Yahoo, for example, the conventional wisdom was that we should target the widest audience possible. But that really hindered innovation at Yahoo, in my opinion, because, you know, for example, when things like dynamic HTML came out and things like that, we were scared to embrace it because we were worried about turning away all these users who were using old browsers. Whereas at Google, the thinking was, well, we should push the envelope and force people to upgrade, you know, so that we can offer better experiences. Like, why hold back people when technology is going in this direction anyway? So that is a really interesting approach. It was very controversial too, at least in the early days, but I think people get it now. I think people understand that.
So it's interesting, you know, seeing this transition at Google. And it sounds like when you joined Google, and you're coming from an HCI background, coming from a design background, you must have felt like a fish out of water, especially coming from Yahoo, where design is on everyone's lips. And you come into a very engineering driven place where the values of the company are really quantitative values, not qualitative. How do you deliver that message in what could be a hostile environment of design is really important, and design's not just about the way something looks, but it's also the way it feels. It's also about how well it works for people, if it's usable and learnable and so forth. How do you deliver that message in an engineering driven culture and start to facilitate change?
You know, I have to say, when I joined Google, I actually didn't feel like a fish out of water as much as I just felt like I was coming home. I mean, actually, Google's culture in many ways was a lot like Netscape's culture and a lot like Yahoo's culture in the early days. If anything, I feel like Yahoo's culture had just evolved to a point where it was just impossible to move things forward. And so at Google, it was really a breath of fresh air because they were so focused on execution and moving things forward, even if they're not necessarily moving forward in the right direction initially. If you keep moving, you'll eventually move in the right direction. If you keep iterating, if you keep getting feedback. And there was always a culture of that at Google, which I have always appreciated. And I think where the rift was there were no visual designers in the company. And there was no formative user research, no generative user research. All of it was summative. It was kind of old school Jacob Nielsen style, you know, assess the performance of the design based on, you know, usability issues, and then throw the report back over the wall to have the team fix those usability issues. And I was really trying to change the way products were conceptualized, and to, you know, it's one thing to build amazing technology, but that technology and all that analysis of the data and whatnot has to be directed towards an empathetic user experience. And so for me, I felt like the place to start was in building greater empathy for users from the beginning, and do that kind of at scale. So I hired Charles Warren from IDEO, who helped IDEO build its organization transformation practice, where, you know, that portion of IDEO at the time was working with clients to help them build in design thinking into their companies. So Charles had kind of productized this, you know, kind of design sprint. And so it was really like taking people through a design thinking process in a very methodical way that's repeatable, reproducible. And what we wanted to do was to turn every engineer, every product manager into a design thinker, so that all products could be conceived with an understanding of users in mind and their needs up front, rather than like, oh, what kind of cool technology can we build? And then figure out like, okay, how do we make this neat prototype look better so that we can launch it and see what happens? So that was really the first place to start, which required formative user research, which sounds obvious now, but very controversial at the time, because, you know, there was this thinking that design and research should be very separate from each other, because otherwise you might influence, you might destroy the integrity of the research, or, you know, if the designers are working too closely with the researchers, which I thought, you know, was kind of the very opposite of where I wanted to go. I wanted to blend the two more closely together so that they were joined at the hip, and so that design, product, and engineering could all operate in a way that's informed and influenced by an understanding of what people need. So that was, those were some of the early things that we tackled.
Support for Design Better comes from Uplift Desk, creators of office furniture designed to help you work better and live healthier. It's been estimated that the average person will spend 1/3 of their life at work. Sobering, huh? That's roughly 90,000 hours at work over your lifetime. Imagine what happens to your body if you're working with bad posture and poor circulation. It can be devastating on your health. That's why Eli and I love Uplift Desk and their ergonomic desks and chairs. Uplift Desk makes solid, well-constructed standing desks that you can customize to match your workspace. And they have a wide variety of incredibly ergonomic chairs. My personal favorite is the Human Scale Freedom Chair. I'm sitting in it right now. For professionals like us, investing in the right tools, especially our desk and chair, is essential. You're going to get free shipping, free returns with free return shipping, and an industry-leading 15-year warranty that covers the complete desk. Eli and I love their products, and we know that you will too. Give it a try. Go to upliftdesk.com and use code DESIGNBETTER5 for 5% off your order. That's UPLIFT desk.com to get 5% off your entire order with promo code DESIGNBETTER5.
So how did, you know, you're in this culture that's very performance driven and they want to see results. How do you kind of sell the whole user focused design thinking approach to people who have, you know, they want to see the data behind it?
As much as people want to see data, like qualitative user research is another form of data. I've heard people dispute the validity of qualitative user research because it's not at scale. It's, you know, it's not large scale. It's not scientific. But qualitative user research tells you the why behind the what and is just as valuable. It tells a deeper story beyond just what the numbers tell you. And, you know, so it's just as an example, it's like if you only look at time spent on a particular page or a feature or whatever, like you don't really know what's going on. Like, are they spending a lot of time there because it's really interesting and engaging? Or are they spending a lot of time on that page because they're totally confused about what to do next? So qualitative research can tell you like a deeper story around what's going on there. And so, you know, whereas people might be skeptical initially, I think people are very easily turned and engaged when they start to see the compelling stories, whether that's in the form of videos or taking people out into the field and having them witness it themselves. So that's kind of the approach that I've always taken, is to engage stakeholders, you know, very personally, so that they can relate to the people that they're building for.
Irene, earlier you were talking about OKRs, which are a really important thing at Google, about accountability and people having clarity of what's expected of them. And that's started to become a really popular thing in other companies as well. How does that fit into design culture? You know, the idea of having specific key results that we're supposed to achieve with design. Does that fit comfortably? Is that a great way to operationalize design at scale to make sure everyone has clarity and accountability?
OKRs are interesting, and I think they're a very effective tool for clarifying what a team is trying to do. In an organization where you have like functional alignment, so like all the designers reporting up into a design team, and then you've got product managers and then engineers reporting up into separate teams, and they're all matrixed in, it can get really tricky because on one hand, you have the cross-functional group that's trying to deliver a product. You know, they should have OKRs that are centered around delivery. But then oftentimes the functional organizations also have OKRs. And so, you know, it's like, how do you align those different objectives up with each other? And so when you have a decentralized organization, I think it becomes a little bit more clear. So if you are the YouTube team, the whole YouTube organization has OKRs, and that applies to product engineering and design. And then it cascades from there. So then when it goes down to an individual designer and their OKRs, it's going to be really about like, what am I going to do this quarter to help the company deliver on this project? You know, centralized or decentralized, I think they're really important, and they only work if it's really, if people understand what the intention is. You know, what is it that the company or the team or the organization is trying to do? What are they trying to accomplish? And so once that intention is clear, then the actions that people take to deliver on that, to move in that direction, becomes a little bit easier to identify.
So team structure is another really important thing as companies start to scale. And there are lots of different ways to structure teams where, you know, you talked about these functional pieces that could be, you know, the YouTube team, which could have engineering and design separate, or they could be cross-functional. A lot of times there's an agency model where designers are all in one team, which is something that Twitter has done in the past, and then decentralized. There are a lot of different approaches. Can you talk about the advantages of different team models that you've seen either in your career or in the companies you're advising, and when might they be most appropriate?
Yeah. You know, in centralized and decentralized, there's no one right answer. It's like a pendulum that swings back and forth and kind of depends on what are you optimizing for. So naturally, like when you have a centralized team, that's a really great way to set in place like a shared sense of values and principles from a design perspective, consistent look and feel. And then from a career perspective, there's a clearer growth path for people. Designers and researchers are more able to collaborate across the organization and to learn from each other. So there's a known path to follow. Like they can get mentorship, and there's because there's more structure in the team, then there's a chance for greater leadership. And so I think that kind of organizational model really suits growing companies very well, particularly with startups, you know, because you know, the company's just not that big, so you might as well have all the designers hang out with each other. And you can get some economies of scale in that way too, because they can kind of reuse work and not reinvent the wheel, because, you know, since they're working more closely with each other, they can share ideas, they can collaborate, and if to the extent that they have different skills that play off of each other, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, and maybe what they produce collectively is better than what any of them can do individually. But as a company grows, it starts to become unsustainable to have like massive centralized teams. People start to complain about their sense of lack of accountability or how inefficiently things get done because you have to work through so many different layers of management. And so usually decentralization happens out of this perceived need for better control or better efficiency or better accountability, all of which can be very valid reasons. And what I've seen both at Yahoo and at Google is that when the teams decentralize and the general managers or the executives in charge of those particular product areas are now responsible for design, it usually leads to a greater investment in design because they're not able to benefit from the efficiencies that were previously held by a centralized team. So then you end up getting more designers hired, but there's also greater duplication of effort, maybe a little bit more reinventing of the wheel. And that's the cost, but the benefit is that people perceive that they can move more quickly because they're in control of their own resources.
How about going over to the design review process? What do you think some key elements of a good design review process are, and who should be involved? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when we spoke to Stanley Wood, he mentioned kind of multiple layers of review, usability or, mm-hmm. or style guide. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that as well.
Yeah. I think it's helpful to also recognize first, like, where do design review processes go wrong first? Mm-hmm. because we've seen a lot of failed cases where teams go in like right before launch and they just want the approval so that they can go launch. And then everything turns upside down because once they go into the committee that reviews, it's like, wait a minute, this concept is completely unfounded. Or, oh my gosh, you mean that you've replicated all of the photos 6 times over on a user's hard drive just to create this experience? Like, I actually sat through a review with Yahoo Photos one time where that happened. And so I think it's really important to have reviews through multiple phases of a product development's lifecycle, starting from, you know, strategy and concept to how is this thing going to be architected, to how do you move people through the experience, and, you know, all the way down to the tactics around, like, how do people perform specific tasks and get things done? What does the interface look like? How does it relate to, you know, company style or brand or things like that? And then making sure that the right kinds of questions are answered in the right stages of review. So even going so far as to offer templates for people to say, okay, these are the questions that we're going to be asking. This is kind of the level of understanding that we're looking for. You know, so maybe in the early stages, it's going to be like, who's the target user? What are their goals? What are they trying to accomplish? What are you trying to get them to do? How does this fit in with our overall company strategy? And then maybe in the later stages of review, it's going to be things like, okay, what does the UI framework look like? And does it adhere to the grid structure that we have created as a standard for the company?
So I was recently at a conference where we had somebody from Search Inside Yourself, and he mentioned this really interesting project, Aristotle. Did that happen when you were at Google?
I'm not familiar with that.
So they did a bunch of research on teams, and, you know, in a very googly way, they used a bunch of data and determined that the number one performance indicator was establishing trust in the team. And so I'm curious, how in these types of reviews, how do you establish trust and how do you make people feel safe so that all perspectives are welcome?
Well, I think it's important to distinguish between a review versus a brainstorm and like a design sprint, you know, because in those meetings especially, you want to have you want people to feel safe because they're generating ideas and you want people to come up with really crazy ideas. Whereas, like, when you're on a tail end of a review right before launch, you know, the objective is a little bit different. At the same time, you want to have constructive criticism at any phase and stage and some creative conflict. So that means that, you know, if people feel too safe, maybe they don't feel like maybe they're not motivated to deliver and push themselves. On the other hand, if there's too much tension, then maybe people don't feel like they can come up with interesting and new ideas. So like in the earlier stages, when we're generating a lot of ideas, we will explicitly say, like, this is a period when we are just going to come up. The objective is to come up with as many ideas as possible. And we are not judging the ideas now. We're not judging you personally, and we're not judging the ideas. And it's really important that whoever is facilitating the meeting is really on the ball when it comes to this, because inevitably somebody will blurt out like, oh, I think that's a terrible idea when somebody comes up with something crazy. And it's really important for the facilitator to kind of, you know, corral that back in and say, you know, thanks for sharing your opinion, but this is not the time and place to do that. We're going to be sharing our judgments later during this other review period or this other phase of the design sprint or whatever. So it's really important for the facilitator to hold the space in an appropriate way. We'll also, like during brainstorming phases, be as encouraging as possible. So not only to withhold judgment, but also to build off of people's ideas. So to never say no to anything that comes up, but to say yes and, you know, that's like a classic improv kind of principle. So that you're saying, yeah, that's a great idea. And what if we also did blah, 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 so that you're building off of each other's ideas and not shooting anybody down. And again, that's very important in the formative stages and the brainstorming stages. And then later when we're editing and we're trying to figure out like, you know, how do we converge down to the two or three ideas that we'll actually pursue and try, then that's the time to kind of be more critical and to say, well, this one has its pros and cons because of these reasons. This one has its pros and cons because of these reasons. And I think it's also really, really important to lay those out very clearly, pros and cons of option A, pros and cons of option B, C, et cetera, so that people can make informed decisions in a balanced way.
Irene, you've probably hired a lot of people over the years and looked at a lot of different skill sets, a lot of different resumes, but to what extent is EQ and soft skills, how important are they to being able to build really great products?
Oh, extremely important and often overlooked more so than they deserve. In my experience, EQ has really determined whether somebody is an okay designer to whether somebody is a really great designer. Because a lot of times it comes down to how present can they really be when they're collaborating with others and when they're making? How empathetic can they be with not only the people that they're designing for, but also with other stakeholders to be able to understand other perspectives so they can negotiate and communicate with them effectively? You know, there's also the importance of being able to receive feedback and to reflect on oneself to see, like, how can I be better and how can I make this thing that I'm creating be better? And so, like, if you have a lack of self-awareness or an unwillingness to look at yourself, that's going to be career limiting in the long run. So I spend just as much time interviewing people for, you know, their EQ as much as I do for their IQ and for their hard skills.
I was just going to say, you know, every time I've interviewed that, I spend so much time just hanging out with candidates because it's the only way to really get a feel for soft skills and EQ and background. And if there's a deficiency in skill set, that's usually something I can coach up, but I can't change a person's, you know, background, personality, the way they communicate and process emotion. That's all on them.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. And I've developed some specific questions in interviews just to be able to try to assess their self-awareness, self-reflection, social awareness, you know, because those are so important. Like, how well do they manage difficult situations? How well do they negotiate with other stakeholders when there's a conflict that arises? Do they ever think about, like, how would I make this better? And what exactly would that look like if they had more time? How would they improve the product? So those are all indicators that kind of reflect on, you know, on their EQ.
It's wonderful. So, you know, you see a lot of companies in your current role at Kosla. What are some of the companies you're seeing that are really embracing design and doing amazing things?
So Kosla Ventures is really interesting because Vinod really loves design and cares about design. So we've invested in some companies like Square, for example, that like really gets design up front. You know, but we also have companies in our portfolio that may not be well-known consumer brands, but are amazing design-focused companies. And Nutanix is one of the companies that I'm most excited about because the CEO, Dheeraj Pandey, really understands that in order for that company to be successful, And they build like data center infrastructure, like hardware and software. And so it's like one of the last companies you would think like really needs good design. But actually, that insight is like they're so design focused, not necessarily not just on how it looks, but like why are they building what they're building? So they recognized that they could automate more. They could create a single interface through which all these different components of data centers could be managed. And so before they build anything, they ask themselves, what is the fundamental problem that we're solving? Like, why are we building this? And so it imposes a really important critical period of reflection around like, well, is this really the best possible solution that we could build? Or is there some more elegant solution that we can arrive at that makes things even easier for people? There's another company. We have a lot of entrepreneurs that are brilliant technologists and know nothing about design. And yet they are so eager to absorb everything that I might have to offer. Like I had one CEO come to me and say, teach me everything you know about design. And this startup is building, they're applying machine learning and artificial intelligence towards network security. So it's like another domain where it's like you wouldn't really think that design has a huge role in this, but he's so eager. And this is one case where the best impact that design can have, it really is in instilling a culture of design thinking into the company so that they're focusing on the customers first. So I taught him how to do field studies. We went and talked to target customers that we had identified. And tried to understand, like, from a chief information security officer's perspective, like, what does their daily life look like and what are their pain points? And that all of that kind of fed into a design sprint that I led with them, which really resulted in a conceptualization of, like, okay, well, these are the possible things that we could do as we direct our technology towards solving these problems. So these are just a few examples of how I've been working with startups in our portfolio. It's a full range, you know, so sometimes the CEO gets it, like Jack Dorsey, and I, you know, they build in design from the, you know, from day one, and there's a huge focus not only on design thinking but also on the aesthetics, and that full range everywhere in between. And then we also get small startups that are founded by technologists that know nothing about design, but are really eager to see how they can make their companies successful through design.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for sharing all these stories, and we really, really appreciate having you on the show, Irene.
Sure. Thank you for having me.